through the my first opening it up, they're going to be back in the waiting room.
Yes, I will add people as they arrive.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we are going to get started. Hello and welcome to our webinar today on making the sentencing case. On behalf of Juvenile Law Center, the Arizona Capital Representation Project, and our extraordinary group of researchers from Yale and from Harvard, my name is Marcia Levick, and I really just want to thank you all for joining us here today. We have a national audience from across the country, so I also want to be respectful and say both good morning and good afternoon. I hope it's not good night anywhere. As I said, just very grateful for you joining with us for this really important conversation. I wanted to say something about the genesis of how we got here today. I'm going to assume that the vast majority of you who have chosen to join us are folks who are in the thick of it. And by that, I mean who have been involved perhaps for years in the sentencing and resentencing of both youth and young adults in the criminal justice system. And while I think many of us thought that the science was quite settled about the traits and characteristics of youth and increasingly matched characteristics in young adults that really drove the United States Supreme Court sentencing cases over the last 15 years, it turns out there's a bit of a counter narrative out there that is attempting to debunk actually the research foundation that we have all relied on. We're going to shorthand that that counter narrative and refer to it as the Wellner Report. This is in fact a report that was prepared by Dr. Wellner and his own group of peers and colleagues. It has been introduced in some sentencing cases and resentencing cases across the country. We think the first one might have been, or at least we know the first one where there was an evidentiary hearing was in a case in Colorado that Rebecca Woodman handled. And our goal today, as I said, is to provide you with the tools and the knowledge and the information to debunk the debunkers. And we think that it's critically important that as we move forward in this space, that we all have the tools that we need, the knowledge and the wisdom that we need to be able to do that. So we have a terrific panel that we have assembled here today. And I'm excited to share the screen both with our researchers and scientists and our lawyers and practitioners. What we have done is we have put their bios into the chat room. And I think as you all get admitted into the webinar, if you click on the chat room, we have short bios for each of them so that you will have a sense of who it is that you're hearing from today. And if they want to take a one sentence moment to introduce themselves, they can also do that. We are going to hear first from the scientists and secondly from the lawyers. The webinar is scheduled for 2 hours, and it is our intention to keep our own conversations to a very tight 90 minutes and to have 30 minutes for a Q&A. How we would like to handle the Q&A is to invite you, please, as you are listening, to, if you have questions, to please put them into the chat room. Karen Lindell from Juvenile Law Center is going to be curating those questions for us. And when we get to the Q&A part of the webinar, I suspect that what Karen will probably do is to really pull out themes that have emerged from all of you that you would like to hear more about from both, again, our scientists and our lawyers. And we will do the best to cover what we can. Obviously, we recognize that time is short. The webinar is being recorded so that if you have colleagues who were unable to attend with us today, please let them know. We will house it on Juvenile Law Center's website. It will likely be housed on the Arizona Capital Representation Project's website. And if there are other venues for streaming, we will also let you know that and make sure that that information is available to colleagues. Lastly, you are all muted, and we are not letting you unmute yourselves. I hope that works, so that we will just be hearing from the speakers themselves. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to our scientists.
Thank you very much, Marcia, and all of you in attendance today. So we'd like to begin and presenting the science today in the context of the Wellner Report, but we also want to put the Wellner Report in the scientific context. So I first just need to state up front that this commission report of where we are in the moment with our science has been interpreted falsely as a peer-reviewed meta-analysis, when in fact it reflects a selection of a few findings and really doesn't represent an objective overview of the empirical evidence to date. Now, this may be in part because the authors of the Wellner Report do not have the expertise in adolescent development, and so we thought it would be important today to have scientists who have the relevant expertise. And so these include my colleagues, Dr. Leah Somerville from Harvard University, who I think today would be called the go-to person when you want to ask questions about adolescent brain and social behavior. And also my colleague, Arielle Baskin-Summers, who is at Yale. And not only is she an expert in antisocial behavior in controlled settings like her laboratory at Yale, but she also has a laboratory within Connecticut's correctional facilities. We thought it would be helpful to put forward the three claims that the panel's comments today will address or touch on. And there are three key ones. The first is an argument that the Wellner Report makes generally that cognitive abilities and brain development is mature by age 16. A second calls into question the Miller decision in saying that the research that they used was not based on adolescents who engage in serious or extreme behavior, such as antisocial behavior. And the third is their claim that youths who commit violent crimes have lasting personality traits and psychopathology that lead to being lifetime predators that is beyond any remediation. And we'll be speaking to this too and countering that argument based on science. So there are three key themes that we'll cover in this panel from the scientists today. The first is development. And so Leah Somerville is going to clarify for you the science on typical brain and behavioral changes that occur through adolescence and well into the 20s. And these changes are functionally significant and relevant to the law. The second is on stability, or really the lack thereof. So both Leah Somerville and Arielle Baskin-Summers today will show you evidence of how across time and with age, the behaviors that we see in typically developing adolescents and also those that engage in extreme behaviors can change and be modified. And then finally, in terms of predictability, we're on really shaky ground when we try to say, will this young person who committed a crime, can we definitively say if they will commit a crime in the future? And so Arielle will also touch on this topic too with regard to the science. So I want to turn it over now to Dr. Leah Somerville. And again, she'll be focusing her presentation on adolescent development.
Thank you. Can you all see my slides okay?
Yes.
Great, thank you so much. In recent years, we're seeing a growing recognition that human psychological and biological development extends well beyond a person's 18th birthday. In fact, the original definition of 18 as the transition to legal adulthood was not chosen based on biology or psychology, but rather on law and convenience. This extended timeline of human development is reflected in the consensus of many expert and policy groups and in laws that impact the kinds of rights and protections that individuals have at different ages. Many of these rights and protections emerge beyond the age of 18, even in the United States, including the age at which individuals could purchase alcohol or marijuana and others as well. The evolving definition of adolescence as a transitional period has been reflected more and more in dialogue from both scientists and public health experts. And this infographic shows that there's a tremendous range of definition of this transitional period and what age in particular it might map to. And I'm going to, throughout my talk, highlight the age of 18 as a blue line going from top to bottom of any graphs that I show, just to give a reference to the legal definition as we go through. And this new adolescence line, which you can see toward the center of this graphic, reflects a consensus recommendation that was recently put forward by public health experts. The continued progression of development beyond the age of 18 is reflected in many measures of brain development. The Wellner Report uses selective evidence to argue that most developmental milestones may be complete by the age of 16, and also questions whether brain development is relevant to behavior and psychological functioning. And I'd like to show you some evidence indicating that both brain development continues and is relevant to psychological functioning, in fact. The scientific consensus that has emerged from research over the last two decades has really demonstrated in many, many ways how brain development continues well beyond a person's 18th birthday. And I'm going to show you a few pieces of evidence about this without getting into the scientific weeds too far. And I could have chosen dozens or maybe even hundreds of demonstrations of continued brain development past age 18, but I've prioritized those studies which are the largest and most definitive out there. So this here is a graph that demonstrates that structural brain development, a very simple metric of measurement of the brain, is continuing to change beyond the 18th birthday. What this is measuring are a set of individuals, with each person's data representing a line because they've been tested at least two separate times with a time gap in between. So any line which represents a person that has a slope to it indicates that there's continued change in that individual's brain measurement of brain volume. And as you can see here, at almost every individual person level, we see this characteristic decline in brain structural volume with age, with increasing age, and very few flat lines or lines that are not showing evidence of continued maturation even beyond the age of 18. A second measure that I'm going to show you here is about brain connectivity, which is essentially a measure of the degree of integrated crosstalk across multiple brain regions. And in this study, each person is a dot, and we are showing the kind of age curve or the curve of characteristic brain connectivity as it is changing with age. And as you can see, brain connectivity, first of all, generally rises with age, but it also continues to rise well beyond that 18-year-old blue line, in fact, continuing to increase even into the 20s. Two major domains of adolescent development when it comes to psychological functioning that are relevant to the law include sensitivity to rewards, which could, of course, drive behavior in the moment, as well as the development of sophisticated cognitive skills that may serve roles in things like choosing actions or making decisions. Wellner implies that these processes are not unique during adolescence, that reward sensitivity may peak very early in sort of pre to early adolescence, and that cognitive development is relatively stable by mid to late adolescence. But this claim is not supported by the consensus among psychological and brain science research. So providing one snippet of evidence that represents the consensus about reward sensitivity, this is a study that measured the brain's response to reward in a large sample of over 250 individuals that were tested multiple times as they grew up. So this is called a longitudinal study, which is a very privileged type of data within this field. And the gray line that we're seeing sort of peaking in late adolescence represents the overall trend of reward sensitivity across age. And we see a very clear peak in mid to late adolescence, the peak is solved at about 17 years of age. And you can see as well that it's elevated relative to both earlier and later developmental stages. Now, turning to the more cognitive parts of development, we can think about the sophisticated kinds of skills that might be involved in making complex decisions or selecting actions. And one of those skills that's important is working memory, that is the ability to hold multiple pieces of information in mind and then use them flexibly to guide our actions. This is a study that characterized working memory across a wide range of participants, 8 to 22 years, and this has over 900 individuals as part of their study, so it's a very large definitive demonstration. You can see here this upward trend in performance such that as individuals are growing older in age across this range, including beyond the 18th birthday and also beyond 16, that individuals are improving in their working memory ability throughout this range of age. Another domain of research that often captures the interest of legal scholars and legal professionals is that those factors that guide adolescent decisions. And I'd like to argue today and show you evidence that adolescent decision-making is tuned differently than adults. In certain ways that are very important for thinking up with nuance and thinking with a little bit of complexity about how adolescent decision making is different than adult decision making. And when it comes to decision making, there's lots of themes. I'm going to focus today on two, which is an appetite for risk or a willingness to take on risky choices. And secondly, on the degree to which the context or the sort of decision conditions surrounding a choice influence an individual's choices. So when it comes to risky decisions, there have been many, many laboratory studies that compare the decision-making preferences of adolescents with adults to ask whether one group or the other group is differentially risky in their choices than others. Now, what I'm showing you here, and I'm going to sort of emphasize this data point, is this is the result of what's called a meta-analysis, which essentially takes many, many studies and many, many different research findings and puts them all together and asks what findings are most sort of characteristic or capture the overall pattern that's found across many, many studies. So this is a sort of consensus analysis across the entire field. Now, these studies on each row, which is represented by author names, is each a study that compares preferences for risk in an adolescent sample compared with an adult sample. And there's a black line toward the center of this graphic. If the data point, that little dot with the line around it, if it falls right at the zero point, which is this black line, that would mean that adolescents and adults show the exact same preference for risk. Any data point that goes to the right of that line means that adolescents express more risk in their choices than adults. So if we're putting all of these data points together and asking what is statistically reliable, looking at this as a whole, this diamond at the bottom tells the story, which is that it is significantly to the right of this line, indicating that adolescents are more likely than adults to prefer taking risks in their choices. And we could have another conversation about why this emerges, whether this is in some ways might be adaptive for adolescents in some contexts. I'm going to stray away from that tangent for right now and stay focused on the point, but it's a very interesting kind of thing to think about. The second way that adolescent decisions consistently differ from adult decisions is that they tend to be more susceptible to the outside conditions that might shape their preferences for risk in the moment. And the particular conditions I'm going to focus on today are making decisions in the heat of the moment or under conditions of arousal and excitement. Now, there have been some very elegant studies that have shown that adolescents are more malleable or that their decisions are more shapeable by these outside decision conditions. And I'm going to show you an example of what this would look like in a laboratory study. I might tell you that I'm going to have you play a card game where there's lots of cards overturned. And most of these cards are winning cards where you would earn points if you turn them over. But there are a few cards, in this case, three cards, that are bad losing cards. And if you turn one of those over and you don't know where they are, if you turn one of those over, you lose everything. So how many cards would you like to take? That's the sort of central question here. And how willing people are to take more cards is a reflection of how much risk they're willing to take on in order to try to earn these points. Now, I can present you this dilemma and let you think very carefully about how many cards you want. I can let you have time. I can give you a chance to deliberate, use your mathematical skills, and ask you in a very calm way, how many cards would you like to take? Now, that's what this study did, and they compared the cards taken by adolescents and adults. And under this very kind of calm, deliberating kind of condition, we actually see adolescent decisions being highly similar to older individuals' decisions. That is, when given this chance to deliberate and think very carefully, adolescents are no more risky than adults. However, that all changes as soon as you make this card game more exciting. And you can do that by having them, instead of thinking carefully and having lots of time to decide how many cards they want, you could ask them, would you like to take a card? You could turn over the card in the moment and they get a smiley face and some points. And then you ask, do you want another card? How about another? How about another? This condition has been shown to increase the bodily arousal that individuals experience and feel more exciting. And as soon as you put this same decision situation in a more exciting condition, you end up seeing a very different pattern of decisions. Now, all the individuals in this study in all the age groups will take more cards when it's in this exciting condition at the top line I'm showing you here. But this is especially the case for adolescents. In other words, their own risk preferences move further toward risk when there's excitement compared to the exact same thing for young adults. And this leads us to think of adolescent decisions as more susceptible to this arousal and excitement in the environment. Now, the last point I'd like to make is about the concept of stability or changeability with development. Adolescence is by definition a transitional stage of life during which individuals are unique compared to their older and younger selves. And this is evident in a number of different preferences and attitudes and behavioral tendencies that we do see as being highly characteristic of adolescence. I'll just show you one here, which is individuals' preferences for sensation seeking, which is a concept that basically encompasses a taste or appetite for excitement, new things, and exploration. Now we see here, and this is from a survey of over 5,000 individuals across the world, met across 17 different countries, that there tends to be a characteristic elevation in sensation seeking or this excitement seeking during the late adolescent years compared to earlier and later. Now, what this kind of graph implies is that people have this temporary elevation, but they grow out of it, essentially, that most individuals will show a decline in this preference with time. And I just wanted to point out, for the sort of connecting to the legal context, that this sort of elevation, this temporariness of the elevation of sensation seeking, is very reminiscent of a similar kind of shape to the characteristic age crime curve, which I'm sure you are all familiar with, that there is a temporary elevation in criminal activity, but that individuals by and large mostly age out of it. So with that, I'm going to close and turn the floor over to my colleague, Ariel Baskin-Summers, who's going to talk about antisocial behavior, personality, and the like. Thank you.
Thank you, Leah.
Can everyone see the screen here clearly?
The screen looks like it's a display as opposed to a PowerPoint, Ariel. I had that problem earlier, so you make me feel better. There's some great questions that are showing up on the chat board too that are very exciting.
Better?
Great.
Okay, great. Thank you for that presentation, Leah. What I'm going to do now is talk a bit about the points that Wellner et al. Make about personality development and psychopathology. Wellner et al. Spend a good time of their report discussing the development of personality traits that we find in the population generally. Personality tends to be the distinctive patterns of thinking, feeling, and behavior among individuals. And they report that personality develops in a nonlinear way across time. And this is absolutely correct. What we tend to see actually is that there's a lack of permanence in personality across time and across situations. Wellner et al. Spend time talking about work by Roberts and colleagues, so I'm going to use that to highlight two examples. First is the personality trait related to conscientiousness. This is really about self-control and overlaps quite a bit with some of the controlled behavior and functions that Dr. Somerville just reviewed. And what we can see here in the peach color bars is that starting at around age 22, there is substantial variability within individuals or change in their expression of conscientiousness. Another personality trait is emotional stability, which is your ability to manage your negative emotions. We see at around age 18 to 22, there is not much change within individuals, but starting after age 22, there is substantial, again, variability and changeability within individuals in terms of their expression of their emotional stability. Since personality is constantly changing, even past age 18, to punish youth indefinitely for actions from one developmental period then just seems illogical. And by having long incarcerations into early adulthood, we are really cutting off chances for an individual to reap the benefits of typical developmental change across the lifespan. Now, some personality traits can be expressed in extreme ways, resulting in psychopathology. Wellner et al. Highlight three forms of psychopathology in youth: conduct disorder, callous on emotional traits, and psychopathic traits. While these forms of psychopathology are not highly represented in the general population, they tend to be overrepresented in justice-involved youth. So we see that about 30 to 50% of justice-involved youth would meet a diagnosis for conduct disorder. Of those with conduct disorder, another 12 to 33% have a specifier of callous unemotional traits, and estimates anywhere from 10 to 30% of justice-involved youth meet diagnoses related to psychopathic traits. All of these forms of psychopathology are associated with early life trauma. For example, conduct disorder is associated with maltreatment, often perpetrated by the caregiver, and exposure to violence in the community. Callous on emotional traits has strong associations with particular parenting styles associated with extreme harshness, physical violence, and low warmth or expression of emotion. And there are certain subtypes of psychopathic traits called the secondary subtype that by definition is associated with experiences of maltreatment. These three forms of psychopathology also are associated with different neurobiological differences associated with emotion and executive functions and control. In many of the same types of behaviors and functions that Dr. Somerville already discussed. For psychopathic traits, we actually see pretty widespread differences across the entire brain that impairs their abilities often to engage in appropriate emotion processing and decision making. It's important to note here at this point, though, that there is no evidence that these neurobiological differences are permanent. In fact, we see changes in the structure and function of these different types of psychopathologies as they relate to brain function. And I'll talk about in a moment how these types of neurobiological aberrancies have evidence of change following appropriate intervention. There certainly is a presence of mitigating factors that could impact emotionality, decision-making, and information processing associated with these forms of psychopathology that Wellner et al. Talk about throughout the report. What they do, though, is to say that in spite of these mitigating factors, the severity of the behaviors that these youth display is so extreme that they are unchangeable and predictive of extreme behaviors in adulthood.
So in the next parts, I would like to highlight the evidence related to the stability and predictability of these particular traits for behavior. Wellner and colleagues focus on these forms and suggest that they're permanent. However, there is now well-replicated evidence that psychopathological traits can decrease without intervention, and with intervention, these traits decrease even more. This is just one example of a study of over 1,000 justice-involved youth followed longitudinally starting at around age 15 up to age 25. We tracked their levels of callous on emotional traits and see that the largest group in this sample, over 57% of this sample, showed a decrease in their callous and unemotional traits, and that is without intervention. This was replicated in a study by Hawes and colleagues that focused on psychopathic traits. Now, there is this group that shows high and stable callous unemotional traits, but for a good percent of youth, there is potential for change, even if they display these traits that Wellner and colleagues suggest are so extreme. And perhaps it's the high group that we should focus on the most, and Wellner implies that if we do, these youth can't change with intervention, so incarceration is the only option. They say that callous unemotional traits have been associated with poor treatment outcomes. Statements like this really reflect an ill-informed perspective of the current literature related to treatment for these types of traits. In fact, treatment for conduct disorder, callous unemotional traits, and psychopathic traits does work. There is strong evidence that multisystemic treatment, which targets the individual, their peers, their family, and the community, results in better behavior and a reduction in traits. There's also strong evidence for the efficacy of parent management training, which works with the child and the individual to improve social-emotional interactions. And there's now increasing evidence of efficacy related to youth-focused interventions. And today I'm going to highlight one that comes out of a facility in Wisconsin, the Mendota Mental Health Facility. Mendota houses youth who have committed a variety of crimes, and those, including those who commit murder, which is something that Wellner and colleagues like to focus on. This type of intervention is an intensive program that has youth earn privileges for periods of positive behavior. They receive points at the end of the day so that they could track their behavior through time, and they're given feedback by rewarding pro-social behavior and increasing desirable privileges. On average, this treatment program is about 45 to 80 weeks, depending on the youth's sentence. What we see is that regardless of the level of traits associated with conduct disorder, callousness, and psychopathy, that there is an improvement in behavior in these purple boxes following treatment. And what I mean by improvement is actually youth who receive the Mendota treatment showed lower violent offending after treatment. There's also some preliminary evidence that there are changes in the brain areas associated with emotion processing and emotion regulation following this treatment. So certainly treatment is challenging for these youth. They often start off worse. Pharmacological interventions don't really help for antisocial behavior, though can help with attention and hyperactivity issues. But there is no evidence that these youth are treatment resistant or even less responsive to treatment. The key is about giving the right treatment. And unfortunately, in most prison systems, the types of treatments that work are not actually offered for youth with these disorders. The final point I want to highlight is that Wellner et al. Suggests that these forms of psychopathology are strong predictors of later behavior. However, a majority of youth who have different forms of antisocial psychopathology do not grow up to have adult forms of antisocial psychopathology. For example, in several studies, we see that only about 10% of youth with a diagnosis of conduct disorder actually grow up to have antisocial personality disorder, the adult expression of these types of behaviors. Therefore, there is little predictive certainty in terms of the extreme behaviors and pathologies that Wellner et al. Report on. Moreover, it is difficult to predict who will recidivate in youth, and it's dependent on a host of factors that are really not only about the individual, but also about the context they're in, the peers they hang out with, the communities they live in, and very importantly, if they find themselves incarcerated early in life, the prison system that they're exposed to. Not all people who murder are high on psychopathological traits, and only about 1 to 2% of people who murder will commit murder again. So in terms of prediction, we're talking about predicting a very uncommon behavior in a very small group of individuals, which is really hard to do. I will say that there is evidence that callous on emotional and psychopathic traits as extreme examples of antisocial behavior do predict future criminal offending in men, although not as strongly in women. But again, as I just reviewed, these traits are not permanent, whether it's through natural development or through intervention. Assuming that youth who murder have psychopathology is flat out wrong. Youth with diagnoses can be informative and predictive, but they're certainly not deterministic. Which brings me to an important methodological point related to how we evaluate whether something is a good predictor or not. Wellner et al. Cite work by Edens, who shows small effects for predicting institutional violence in individuals with psychopathic, callous on emotional, and conduct-related traits. This raises the issue of the difference between statistical significance and a clinically meaningful effect. Statistical significance is the extent to which there are differences between groups and whether that is due to chance. So if group A is different than group B, we would say if it's statistically significant, that is not due to chance. An effect size is the meaningfulness of that result, and we often talk about this in terms of small, medium, or large effects. And this really relates to the impact of the difference or the strength of that effect. So statistical significance is, was there a difference or not? And effect size is the strength of that difference. And the data provided by Edens et al. Show that the predictive utility of these types of psychopathologies is modest at best. And in fact, there was substantial variability depending on the outcome, with some effects showing very small predictive utility. And when we are talking about individuals' lives and trying to consider their future behavior, we really want to ensure that the tools we're using to predict have large and strong effects. So to assume that psychopathology in youth is a strong predictor of future behavior that warrants a long sentence certainly is erroneous.
Thank you, Ariel. I appreciate that overview. And just to make that last point even clearer, in the context of COVID-19, we want our vaccines and our treatments to have meaningful effects and change. So I think that's a very important point and causing to question some of the arguments and the data that the Wellner Report relies on. So I just want to give a brief overview, sort of take-home messages for the group. I think it's clear from the presentation that when we're working with justice-involved youth, that we really need to consider the developmental stage, the capacities that that individual brings to a situation, the circumstances which may diminish their ability to make good decisions, and these changes that occur from adolescence well into the early 20s, and also the environment. I think Ariel really hit home in terms of the environment, the home, the community, prison, whether or not we have support, the lack of support, or even exposed to violence in those environments is going to be very important in its impact on youth. And then mental health. We talked about extreme behaviors today, but we could spend a whole panel talking about justice-involved youth who have other mental health problems, including depression and risk for suicide. Leah Somerville just gave us sort of the frosting on the cake, but referenced a number of studies, particularly meta-analyses, longitudinal studies, showing from decades we've known that adolescents are different from adults. And they're different from adults in cognitive abilities, when they're complex, they're making difficult decisions, sensitivity to rewards. When there are arousing situations, that's going to impact their decision-making, and also that they're sensation-seeking. But these behaviors and tendencies, they change, just as the brain is changing during this time. And even youth that engage in criminal behavior, even violent criminal behavior, show change as well and are modifiable. And then finally, It's important to keep in mind in sentencing that with little intervention or opportunity for change or the tools for change, we're really putting these young people at risk. And by doing that, we're also putting our society at risk. So I'd just like to thank the panel members again. Now move on to our legal scholars' presentations. Thank you.
Thanks, BJ, and thank you, Ariel and Leah. That was amazing. And really, I think the juicy stuff that everybody is here for. I'm Amy Armstrong. I'm with the Arizona Capital Representation Project, and I'm just going to kick off the attorney segment here. We actually decided to pre-record our session because we have children that are homeschooling and dogs that are barking at FedEx deliveries, and we just wanted to make absolutely sure we didn't have a issue. And also we wanted to make sure that our presentation was as tight as possible because there's so much you can say about how to litigate these complex issues and especially how to deal with the Wellner report, which the lawyers in our presentation referred to as the forensic panel report. But I want to make clear that we're all talking about the same document. Karen is going to start our recording for us, and essentially we're going to talk about the litigation end of addressing this report.
Hey everybody, my name is Sam Koistra. I'm staff counsel at the Arizona Capital Representation Project, and today I'm going to be providing you with an overview of the Supreme Court's juvenile sentencing case law. So a lot of this will be familiar to all of you, but the objective here is just to put the science lecture we just heard into its legal context, and also to set my colleagues who are going to be talking about sort of the application of these concepts. So when we talk about the Supreme Court's core juvenile sentencing cases, we're really talking about these four cases. So Roper v. Simmons from 05, Graham v. Florida from 2010, Miller v. Alabama from 2012, and Montgomery v. Louisiana from 2016. And these cases taken together to develop the court's Eighth Amendment jurisprudence when it comes to sentencing juveniles. And as you see, all of these decisions are directly informed by the science that we just heard about. Okay, so let's go through these and take these kind of one by one. So in 2005, we have Roper v. Simmons. This is a famous case where the court held that if you are a juvenile at the time of your offense, you are categorically ineligible to receive the death penalty, right? Children cannot be sentenced to death. And in reaching this conclusion, the court drew upon a lot of different factual and legal regimes, but a major one was what it termed scientific and sociological studies that show that children have these characteristics that distinguish them from adults, right? So these are traits like a greater susceptibility to outside influences, lesser maturity, greater impulsivity and rashness, and a greater capacity for reform when compared to adults, right? Children have these distinct qualities that make them categorically less culpable under the Eighth Amendment than adults. And in reaching this conclusion about how these children are different and how that's constitutionally significant, the court explicitly relied on science, right? If you read through the opinion, the court cites to scientific studies and research going back as far back as the 1960s, right? So they cite to Larry Steinberg, they cite to Eric Erickson, they cite to amicus briefs by the APA, right? And they're relying on all of these scientific sources to reach the conclusion that children are fundamentally different in a way that is constitutionally significant. Okay, so let's go forward 5 years. So in Roper, we were dealing with the capital sentencing context. Now in Graham, in 2010, the court is taking on non-capital cases. And what it holds is that for juveniles convicted of non-homicide crimes, they are, just as juveniles are ineligible for the death penalty, juveniles who commit non-homicide crimes are ineligible for life without parole, or LWOP. Again, sort of the rationale of this holding is based explicitly on science, right? They look at the same scientific and sociological differences between children and adults to conclude that there are these differences between adults and children that require a different treatment for children at sentencing. And it looked, again, at the sources the court relied on in Roper, and it said that, you know, the developments over the, you know, the five preceding years continue to show fundamental differences between juvenile and adult minds, right? So the science was in place in 2005. It's changed, grown since then, but those that change in growth only confirms what we know about children are different. In fact, you know, as we just heard, that science has continued in the decade since Graham and continues to show, it continues to affirm the basis that children are different than adults. Again, the court is citing and relying explicitly on scientific sources, talking about amicus briefs from the AMA and the APA, and it says it has there's no reason to reject the basic science that was underlying Roper. Okay, next up we have Miller v. Alabama and Montgomery v. Louisiana. This is 2012 and 2016. And I group these together because they kind of have to be read together. Montgomery talks about how it clarifies what the ruling was in Miller. But read together, what these cases hold is that a juvenile who commits a homicide, right? Graham was about juveniles who commit non-homicide crimes. Miller and Montgomery, if a juvenile commits a homicide crime, they are ineligible for the life without parole unless they are found to be what the court terms irreparably corrupt, right? The court says in most cases when a juvenile commits any crime, including a homicide, the crime will be a product of transient immaturity. And if that is the case, the crime is a product of transient immaturity, then categorically that defendant, that child defendant, cannot be sentenced to life without parole. Again, the court repeats this refrain you're hearing throughout these cases: children are constitutionally different from adults for purposes of sentencing. Again, the court is explicitly relying on scientific sources. We're talking again about briefs from the APA and the AMA. And again, as with Graham, the court looks at developments in the science that has occurred since the prior cases and confirms, right, that the evidence presented to us in Miller indicates that science and social science supporting Roper and Graham have become even stronger, right? So the court is continuously updating and checking the science and finding it still holds water, it's still correct. And so what do we do with that science? Well, again, it's the distinctive attributes of youth diminish the penological justification for imposing the harshest sentences on juvenile offenders, even when they commit terrible crimes, right? So what are these distinctive attributes of youth? Well, again, that's these scientifically verifiable traits like impulsivity, immaturity, susceptibility to influence, capacity for rehabilitation, and so on, right? So at the core of this is these scientific conclusions about how children are different. Okay, so that's the very rapid overview of the cases. So what are the key takeaways from, you know, looking at these all together? Well, the first thing is that the Supreme Court has repeatedly, time and again, affirmed the validity of the science. From 2005 to the present, they checked it, rechecked it. This is the science. This is correct. This should inform our jurisprudence. The second thing I'd like to highlight is what the science tells us, right? The court has found again and again that according to the science, children are different from adults in ways that are constitutionally significant, and that these differences diminish the culpability of children and make them ineligible for the most severe penalties. Okay, and then the final thing, the third thing, is that these differences are categorical in nature. What the court is describing is differences between children and adults that are present in all children, right? Children as a class. It's not only children who commit certain crimes or, you know, have certain traits. If you are a child, scientifically, we know you possess these characteristics. And it's nothing crime specific, as Miller says, about these traits. So that's sort of the broad overview of where the Supreme Court is coming from, especially as it relates to science. Right now, I'm going to hand things over to my colleague, Rebecca, who's going to take this legal framework and give you sort of an as-applied, you know, version of it.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Woodman. I'm an attorney in Kansas City, and I've been engaged in death penalty defense for about two decades now. And I recently confronted the forensic panel report in the context of litigating a Roper extension motion in a Colorado death penalty trial. And this was before Colorado abolished the death penalty last spring. So I've had to deal with the forensic panel report firsthand, and that's what I'm going to talk about today. While I will be specifically talking about litigating a Roper extension motion involving the death penalty, the analysis that I'm discussing here is also relevant to litigating similar motions under Graham and Miller involving life without parole. And by Roper extension motion, I mean a motion arguing that the categorical exclusion from the death penalty for juveniles, as was decided in Roper versus Simmons that Sam just outlined for you, should be extended to emerging adults ages 18 to 21 because, as you heard earlier from our scientific experts, adolescent brain development doesn't stop at age 18, but continues into the 20s with the same impact on decision-making and judgment that the Supreme Court recognized with respect to juveniles in Roper. So how do you lay the foundation for an evidentiary hearing and hopefully relief on your motion? First of all, you've got to understand the constitutional framework in which this issue has to be presented. The argument here is about excessive or disproportionate punishment in violation of the Eighth Amendment as it pertains to a certain class of persons. Here we're talking about 18 to 21-year-olds. And so the court utilized the constitutional proportionality test in Roper and Graham and in Miller, and this proportionality test is a long-standing test that was developed by the U.S. Supreme Court. It originates from the court's 1948 decision in Trope versus Dulles, where the court made it clear that the Eighth Amendment is not static. Rather, the Eighth Amendment must draw its meaning from the evolving standards of decency that mark the progress of a maturing society, as the court put it. The two-part test for determining whether a particular punishment is disproportionate began with the court's decision in Gregg versus Georgia, which reinstated the death penalty in 1976 after it invalidated the death penalty in 1972 in Furman versus Georgia based upon the way the death penalty was being administered at that time. So the national consensus part of the test, which is the first prong of the proportionality test, is measured by objective indicia to the maximum possible extent. And by objective indicia, we mean things such as legislative enactments and actual sentencing practices to measure where the state of the country is on the imposition of a particular punishment to either a certain offense or a class of offenders. And then the court uses its independent judgment in determining whether a punishment is disproportionate under the Eighth Amendment. And this is a subjective determination where the court essentially looks at whether the punishment serves legitimate penological goals of retribution and deterrence. And you have to demonstrate both of these prongs in order to show that a particular punishment is disproportionate. So let's talk about laying the foundation. In the context of Roper, and consequently in the context of Roper extension, the focus is on the subjective prong of the test. In other words, the court's independent judgment. In Roper, while the court found a national consensus against the execution of juveniles based upon legislative judgments and actual sentencing practices, the focus really was on the scientific consensus that juveniles as a class have diminished culpability. And this diminished culpability, as Sam mentioned, is based on the behavioral and decision-making characteristics of juveniles in three main areas: immaturity and lack of responsibility, increased susceptibility to negative influences and peer pressure, and then these transitory personality traits making the character less fixed. And because of this diminished culpability, The court determined in Roper that imposing the death penalty on juveniles fails to serve legitimate penological goals of retribution and deterrence under the Eighth Amendment, and that the death penalty is therefore a categorically excessive or disproportionate punishment. So within this constitutional framework, you need to lay out the scientific data that supports extending the category to 18 to 21-year-olds. We know from the scientific discussion that BJ, Leah, and Ariel laid out so eloquently earlier, advancements in the scientific understanding support extending the line to the category of emerging adults ages 18 to 21. The scientific data demonstrates that adolescent brain development continues into the 20s, implicating judgment and self-control in ways similar to those identified by the court in Roper and later in Graham and Miller, so that a person within the age group of 18 to 21-year-olds, like juveniles, cannot reliably be classified among the worst offenders, as the court put it in Roper. You can draw on other cases or other decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court, for example, in Hall versus Florida and Moore versus Texas, where the court, in reaffirming that the death penalty is a categorically disproportionate punishment for intellectually disabled offenders, as the court originally held in Atkins versus Virginia, the court in those cases made it clear that it is impermissible to disregard the teachings of the scientific community in determining proportionality of punishment under the Eighth Amendment. And the concern here is with the unacceptable risk that a defendant lacking the requisite culpability might receive a death sentence. And based on the science, a cutoff at age 18 creates an unacceptable risk that the death penalty will be imposed against these late adolescents or emerging adults ages 18 to 21 who also lack the requisite culpability and should not be subjected to the most severe punishment. One note about national consensus. While evolving standards of decency are to be measured by objective factors to the maximum possible extent, as I said earlier, the court has also said that there are other measures of consensus beyond legislation and sentencing practices. In relevant to the context here, for example, the ABA House of Delegates in February of 2018 passed a resolution calling on all death penalty jurisdictions to ban capital punishment for any offender who committed their crime at age 21 or younger. And this resolution was based on what we know about the science and the diminished culpability of persons within this age group. Moreover, youth under age 21 are a protected class for a wide range of legal purposes under laws that recognize their diminished capacity. For example, laws governing child welfare, education, juvenile justice systems, public safety under, you know, laws regulating drug, alcohol, and gun possession, professional licensing, workers' comp, healthcare, youth offender programs, international law. All of these areas of law in virtually every state, definitely most states, recognize the diminished culpability of offenders, of youth, young people under the age of 21. And again, that that recognition that this is a protected class and that they need certain protections is based upon our scientific understanding of their diminished culpability. Don't forget the state constitution. I include this here because it's an important thing to remember. You need to always look at your state constitution to determine whether the language of the state constitutional counterparts to the Eighth Amendment and the Due Process Clause have language that is arguably more protective than the federal constitution, or if the state constitutional provisions have been judicially interpreted to provide more protection than the federal constitution requires. For example, in State versus Gregory, the Washington Supreme Court struck down that state's death penalty law under the Washington state constitution after the court found that the death penalty is administered in an arbitrary and racially biased manner. The Colorado Supreme Court has recognized that state courts are free to consider the merits of a constitutional challenge under their own constitutional provisions and are free to do so independently of U.S. Supreme Court opinions, even when the state and federal constitutions are similarly or identically phrased. The Supreme Court itself has said this many times, that a state can grant its citizens broader protection than the federal constitution requires by enacting appropriate legislation or by judicial interpretation of its own constitution. So always look at your own state constitution when arguing constitutional issues. Countering the forensic panel report, one of the most important things is that you need to get highly qualified expert assistance, expert scientific assistance. You need this assistance not only to make the affirmative case for the science supporting a categorical ban in your original motion, but to assist you in identifying problems with and in neutralizing the forensic panel report in your reply and rebuttal and in an evidentiary hearing if you are so lucky as to obtain one. You need to research the qualifications and prior records of the specific forensic panel authors of the report for disqualifying or impeachment material. For example, in my Colorado case, there were three signatories to the forensic panel report, James Seward, Matt DeLisi, and Thomas Gilmet. None of these people are experts in adolescent brain development. And Matt DeLisi has a PhD in sociology, but that's it. He has no neuroscience background at all. And the forensic panel report was labeled as being the report of Dr. James Seward, but it was signed by all three of these forensic panel members. And so it was unclear what the roles of these other individuals were. Did they contribute to the report? Were they peer reviewers of Dr. Seward? And if they were authors of the report, if they contributed to the report, it was unclear what, if any, portions of the report that they contributed to. To the extent that DeLisi and Gilmet were peer reviewers, I think it's already been mentioned here that that is problematic in the context of Dr. Wellner and the forensic panel, because it's not real peer review. It's essentially a rubber stamp by a forensic panel colleague. And to the extent that that was the case here, it was improper. As I point out in this slide, there are several federal cases in which courts have excluded or limited testimony from Dr. Wellner and or his colleagues from the forensic panel for reasons of unreliability and for breaches of court rules and misrepresentations about their peer review process. In U.S. versus Sampson, for example, the court prohibited Dr. Wellner, who had examined Sampson, from using the term psychopathy in his testimony, and also found that his examination of Mr. Sampson could not be used on the issue of future dangerousness because of the high risk that despite any limiting instruction, the jury would have considered Dr. Wellner's testimony as tending to show that Sampson would be dangerous in the future. And I would urge you to be very careful when you see nomenclature such as psychopathy and antisocial personality disorder, especially in the context of juveniles, emerging adults, and the death penalty in particular. These are very damaging labels, and the prosecution wants to use these labels for the reasons that were the subject of the concern articulated by the court in Sampson. They use these labels to try to kill your client, essentially. And there is a great risk that a jury listening to such labels will determine that your client is a future danger, and that equates to imposition of the death penalty. So be very careful and try to keep that kind of language out. It's not legitimate. in U.S. versus Wilson, the court excluded the testimony of these experts for breaching federal rules of criminal procedure by publishing confidential information on the forensic panel website. And then in U.S. versus Richardson, the court disqualified Dr. Wellner and his forensic panel colleagues from further participation in the case for violating court orders and for the government's misrepresenting or exaggerating the distinctiveness of the forensic panel's use of the peer review process. So the bottom line of the Wellner forensic panel report is, in the death penalty context in particular, is to suggest that we can make reliable determinations based on individualized assessments about which individuals deserve to be sentenced to death and which do not, whether we are talking about juveniles or young adults. The reliable scientific consensus doesn't support this for juveniles or emerging adults in the 18 to 21 age group. The court stated this in Miller, where it said that the science and social science supporting Roper's and Graham's conclusions have become even stronger. And we know from the presentation on the science state of the scientific evidence that that is true, and it applies equally to 18 to 21-year-olds. The forensic panel report is the antithesis of Roper, where the court found that the risk of executing a juvenile with diminished culpability was sufficient to bar execution of the entire class. The court in Roper addressed youth as a mitigating factor because that's what the state argued in Roper, that look, you can address a petitioner's or a defendant's youth at the penalty phase through mitigating circumstances, relying on youth as a mitigating circumstances and presenting evidence in support of that mitigating factor. And the court said, no, that's insufficient in the context of juveniles because the differences between juvenile and adult offenders are too marked and well understood to risk allowing a youthful person to receive the death penalty despite insufficient culpability, and that an unacceptable likelihood exists that the brutality or cold-blooded nature of any particular crime would overpower mitigating arguments based on youth as a matter of course, even where the offender's objective immaturity, vulnerability, and lack of true depravity should require a sentence less severe than death. And the court said in some cases a defendant's youth may be counted against him. And indeed, in Roper itself, the prosecution argued that the defendant's youth should be considered by the jury as an aggravating factor, not a mitigating factor. And so the court said that you can't address this at the penalty phase based upon an individualized assessment because the risks are too great. And what we know about these individuals are that they have a diminished culpability as a class that creates a categorical bar under the Eighth Amendment to imposition of the death penalty against this group. And the same reasoning applies for all of the reasons that we've talked about to the category of emerging adults ages 18 to 21. Okay, I'm going to pass the torch on to Amy Armstrong, who will discuss representation of clients in the post-conviction context involving juvenile life without parole.
Hi, my name is Amy Armstrong. I am the director and staff counsel at the Arizona Capital Representation Project. I've been doing capital work like Rebecca for about the last 20 years and got into JLWAP work very naturally as one of my clients had originally been sentenced to death and had his sentence reversed under Roper v. Simmons. So I've been litigating these issues for a very long time. I want to speak with you today about investigating, developing, and presenting meritorious claims under Roper, Graham, and Miller. And like Rebecca mentioned, I come from the collateral review perspective. I do post-conviction and federal habeas work, but really many of the concepts I'm going to discuss in terms of factual development apply to the trial context as well. So first and foremost, we all need to be familiar with the 2015 guidelines that were created by the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth. They're available online. They're very thorough. And I'm going to touch on several of these guidelines today. But I'm not going to go into detail about them. So just make sure that you have reviewed them. They are not only sort of the guiding light for us in litigating our JLWAP cases, but they also are a tremendous resource when we're litigating for funding and time. Time and resources, the number one thing to be able to do these things, do these cases correctly. Direct and collateral review are not explicitly addressed in the guidelines, but they are in other professional articles and also just in the training that we've all been doing around the country for the last several years as the court's adolescent development jurisprudence has emerged. And the concepts I'm about to, the investigatory concepts I'm about to discuss apply to the non-homicide Graham context, the homicide Miller context, and also the extension context. So really, this is the type of investigation that we want to be doing in all of our cases at all procedural stages. So what do we have to prove? First of all, just note in the collateral review context, we have to make some sort of factual showing with our petition before we can ever even obtain additional evidentiary developments such as discovery or an evidentiary hearing, let alone relief. So we need to do these investigations thoroughly and early so that we can convince the court that we should move on to the next stage of factual development. Like Sam mentioned, I believe Graham really should require no specific fact-finding beyond the fact that the crime is a non-homicide crime and that it was committed by the client prior to the age of 18. But as we'll discuss more later, there are reasons to develop these facts, even though Graham doesn't explicitly require it. Now, in Miller, there is a very explicit factual inquiry that's laid out for us by the court, and that is that we need to show that the crime was a product of our client's transient immaturity or that the client is not irreparably corrupt. And we're going to talk in detail about how to make those showings. Different jurisdictions differ in terms of who has the burden and what the burden is, but no doubt our investigations are going to be centered on proving these legal concepts. And importantly, Miller does not turn on the facts of the crime. I think that was mentioned earlier. We have to resist the prosecution narrative that continually tries to bring the fact finder back to the horrific crime itself. There's some great language in a concurring opinion by Justices Sotomayor and Ginsburg about this concept. They say those prior fact finders, the state courts who are sentencing our clients to life, our adolescent clients to life, did not have the benefit of this court's repeated exhortation that the gruesomeness of a crime is not sufficient to demonstrate that a juvenile offender is beyond redemption. Okay, so we want to keep going back to that and keep refocusing the fact finder on what the JLWAP inquiry is really all about. And then, of course, in an extension context, whether it's Roper, Graham, or Miller, we need to explain why 18 shouldn't be a bright line cutoff, which is, of course, what Leah and Ariel and BJ touched on here. Emerging adults, really the science shows that 18 is not the cutoff for adolescent development. So the guidelines tell us that we need to do a complete mitigation investigation. Here are the reasons why. A complete biopsychosocial history will humanize our client in front of the fact finder. And it also is going to bring the adolescent development data out of this sort of generalized realm that is really discussed in the forensic panel report and bring it into an individualized realm. Now, I want to acknowledge this is a little bit in tension with what Rebecca was saying earlier. We certainly have to keep beating the drum that there is a reason why the Supreme Court has made a categorical exemption for juveniles, and there is a reason that we were trying to protect against this risk that just an individualized sentencing, the way that we have in a capital penalty phase, is not adequate to protect all of these juveniles in light of the force of the scientific consensus that shows that they are still developing and that they are still impulsive and immature. At the same time, there's typically, if not always, so much going on with our clients that's beyond whatever is happening just with their normative development, right? There's also very special circumstances. And so we can develop those and focus on those. And then we're basically, you know, having our cake and eating it too. We have the adolescent development science that applies really to all juveniles, but we also have the unique and individualized circumstances of our client that intersects with that those general truths and gives the court the reason to find for a meaningful opportunity for release and to find that the client is not irreparably corrupt. So a complete biopsychosocial history includes many of the things we're used to collecting for sentencing procedures, records, lots of testimony from lay witnesses in the form of declarations if you're in the collateral review context, artifacts, photos, certificates of achievement, things that really help to bring, especially in the collateral review context, help to bring us out of the, you know, black and white and one-dimensional nature of the petition and really start to bring some life into our client's case and cause. And then, of course, experts. You know, don't limit yourself. There's so many potentially relevant experts that are only limited by the facts of the client, the unique facts and circumstances of the client's life themselves. But we may want a consulting expert. There may be so many things going on with the client that we need someone to help us tease out where we should focus. Prison adjustment, trauma experts, and of course, a developmental expert who's able to discuss and articulate the scientific consensus about adolescent development. So the themes that we are trying to develop, obviously under Miller and all the cases, are immaturity, right? We want to show that, as consistent with the science, our client was displaying signs and symptoms of immaturity, because it's not really necessarily a symptom, because it's not pathological to be immature as an adolescent. But we want to show that our client was displaying signs of immaturity at and around the time of the crime. And if you have a collateral review client, if you're in post-conviction or habeas, you hopefully have evidence that now they are mature, right? And so we want to compare and contrast those types of evidence. We want to look to the circumstances of the offense. Sometimes our clients committed the crimes with older co-defendants, or they displayed childlike behaviors leading up to or during the time of the crime. There could have been peer or familial pressure involved. We want to understand our client's trauma and mental health history. And I think in particular, we want to take a fresh look at racial trauma and any narratives about excessive force and over-policing in your client's community, especially when we have clients who are in post-conviction and federal habeas. They may have been convicted in the 80s, in the 90s, or the 2000s at a time where our sentencers did not appreciate the breadth and depth and severity of the racial trauma that they were suffering, and now would see that same evidence in a very different light than they did back then. So I encourage everybody to look at that aspect of your case. The capacity for rehabilitation and remorse is huge. We know from Capital Jury Project studies that remorse is the number one mitigating factor for capital jurors, and I can promise you it is no different for JLWAP fact finders and also for parole boards. These folks are very interested in narratives around the client accepting responsibility for the crime and being able to express genuine remorse for the crime. Other issues, intellectual capacity. You know, our clients are not fully intellectually formed when they're adolescents, and so we can show a lot about their intellectual achievements later on. And also reentry plans. This is paramount. It's been stunning to me, as somebody who's done capital work for so long, how interested and focused, sharply focused on reentry the fact finders are. Even parole boards who are looking to parole a client to a consecutive sentence of many, many years or even a life term want to know what this reentry plan is. So we have to really dig in and be thorough about that investigation. What are we not so interested in presenting? Really things that that imply or signal that there's some sort of permanent type of damage or disability that can't be overcome. If your client does have a disability that can be overcome with reasonable accommodations, like a client who is intellectually disabled, you just have to investigate and include what the plan is for those specifics. If you have you know, something else that you're on the fence about presenting, like potentially some brain damage, you know, you really want to think about what you're signaling to the court when presenting something that shows long-term unsurmountable problems. And so in short, our mitigation investigation should enable us to tell a detailed, documented life story with a detailed document happy ending. In other words, we want to show the capacity for change. We want to show redemption. We want to show that this client can be released and reintegrated back into the society. So it's important to contextualize the disciplinary history. Obviously, we have to get the records of every single disciplinary from our clients. We want to interview the clients around the disciplinary because often there's just so much context that is not apparent from the records themselves. And we want to interview any potential witnesses. We have declarations from correctional officers, several of them retired, who were directly involved with the disciplinaries that our clients have. And they might have been the victims of them, or they might have been the ones who wrote up the disciplinary, and they can help put the disciplinary in context. We have declarations with them saying, you know, this was relatively minor in the terms of prison, and I would just, you know, really be upset if this was used against the client and his ability to obtain parole or release. That evidence is available to develop under certain circumstances. We also have to remember that, like in the capital context, we are actually creating evidence every day that goes by with our client in prison or in jail pending pretrial. So we have the potential for rehabilitation and action. We often need to help our clients, depending on their level of immaturity, or experience, with cultivating some of these things. So family relationships, pen pals, meaningful spiritual practices and connections. You know, for example, one of our JLWAP clients, it's a Miller case, had a sister who he never met, who had been adopted out at birth, contact him, and he hadn't yet made contact back with her by the time we got involved in the case. So we helped him figure out how to frame his letter back to her, how to start his correspondence relationship, and we sort of counseled him as he continued to develop his relationship with his sister. And after a couple of years, when we came in front of the parole board, the sister was such an articulate and passionate voice in support of the client that we are confident she is the reason, that he was actually paroled to his next sentence. Same thing with employment and volunteering, you know, helping your clients figure out what opportunities there are for them in prison and encouraging them to take advantage of any opportunities that there are, educational, correspondence courses, etc. And lastly, but incredibly importantly, working with our clients on their ability to articulate their remorse. Oftentimes our clients are very remorseful, but because of trauma and other experiences, their ability to communicate that remorse effectively is compromised. So we have to have those conversations with them about remorse and get them practiced at being able to express it in a way that will fall well on the fact finder. Here's some examples of artifacts that you can use in your cases. I just want you to pay attention to the names of the classes, because I think that they are exactly the kinds of courses that fact finders, parole boards, you know, like to see. So this is a certificate of achievement for socialization. This one is called Cage Your Rage. This one is called Responsible Thinking, right? All indicia of maturity. This is a certificate from a correspondence course. This is a actual exam from Bible study that our client got 100% on. And this I like. This is also from our client's Bible study, but he wrote a short answer here. It's a way to bring your client's voice into the petition, or, you know, as an exhibit. It's a way to bring the client's voice out without necessarily having him testify. He says here, "When I was a teen, I accepted Christ as my Savior. I fell from my walk, but thanks be to God, I am now back in close and personal relationship with him." And then the evaluator, the Bible study coach, wrote some really beautiful remarks in response. We have to remember that a picture is worth 1,000 words. This is a photo of my client that was taken at his arrest back when the state was framing him as a dangerous gangbanger. And then this is a photo of my client over 25 years later, And you can just see, you know, the difference in sort of like the closeness and the fear and the tough veneer that's in the original photo, and the openness and really the light that's illuminating from him in the second photo. So just as a way to humanize our clients, make sure that our fact finders can see our clients and also can see the difference. So the experts that you want to use in litigating your JAWOP cases. I mean, first of all, in all of our cases, we have to be careful to distinguish between consulting and testifying experts. The work we do is really complex, and our clients often have complex intersecting mental health events happening. And so it can be really helpful to have a consulting expert who never testifies, where you can share all the information you have about the client and not worry about any disclosure obligations, and they can guide you with picking the best experts for the rest of your case. A testifying expert, of course, is going to testify, and anything that you give to them is going to be discoverable. So just always distinguish between what you're doing there. And also distinguish between teaching experts and experts who actually evaluate your client. Teaching experts can be powerful to introduce concepts such as all of the, you know, scientific consensus on the adolescent development literature that BJ and Ariel and Leah spoke about earlier. But they also are, you know, if that's all you use and you don't use an expert who's actually evaluated your client, then you're going to be vulnerable to the types of attack that are articulated by the forensic report. So I personally like to use clinicians when as testifying experts, clinicians who actually treat adolescents and who have actually met and evaluated my client. The benefit of using a clinician is that they have hands-on real-life experience with children, so they're really able to navigate and rebut some of the ludicrous propositions that the prosecution raises about teenagers and what we should expect from them. Clinicians can discuss the intersection between our client's social history and their trauma history, and also transient immaturity. So we want to be able to talk about the way those things all overlap for our client at the time of the crime. And clinicians are generally great interviewers, so they can get some really good language from your client and important and relevant information from your client about their growth and about their remorse. So we can get ahead of the forensic panel report by having an expert who's familiar with both the prevailing science and the unique circumstances of our client. So I'm just going to quickly go over this because Rebecca touched on many of these points, and of course the experts touched on them in much more depth before. But in terms of the collateral review context, I think we should be prepared to address the forensic panel report, but I wouldn't address it affirmatively in the petition. I think that the narrative in the petition should be a life-affirming story that's client-centered. And then, of course, in the reply, or if we get an evidentiary hearing, then we want to be prepared to take on the forensic panel report, assuming the state used it in their response. So make sure that you have an adolescent development expert, a clinician, whoever you're going to work with as your primary expert on the case, who is comfortable with discussing the scientific consensus and pointing out the problems with the forensic panel report. And they can do that in support of your reply, or if you get a hearing at your evidentiary hearing. Just touch on as many problems with the forensic panel report as you can. You know, one thing is just the price tag. In Maricopa County, we did a public records request and realized that they paid over $500,000 for that report. And we don't even know how much of that report has been written and introduced in other jurisdictions. So we need to really all get together and figure out how much they're charging per jurisdiction to understand just the exorbitant cost that's involved with that document. Of course, what Sam was talking about, that SCOTUS has already adopted and relied upon the scientific consensus, that's something we can use to attack the forensic panel report. And then the things that our experts were speaking about earlier, the lack of peer review, the lack of adolescent development expertise, the improper methodologies. Rebecca went over all of that, but you can use those same arguments in the post-conviction context. So the real takeaway here is just that there are several ways to impeach the forensic panel report. And of course, we need to work on that traditional impeachment. But the other thing that we can do is emphasize, and well, first of all, investigate and develop, and then emphasize the unique circumstances of our client's biopsychosocial history development. This is something we should be doing anyway, under the guidelines. And by doing it, not only are we meeting our burden of proof and improving our clients' chances of relief, but we're also buffering against the impact of the forensic panel report. Thanks.
Thank you. So let me first of all just thank personally our panelists today, Leah, BJ, Ariel, Sam, Rebecca, and Amy. That was extraordinary. And I think being able to, in just 90 minutes, really take us through the journey of continuing to marry the science with advocacy, even as we face new challenges, and being prepared to do that, I'm extremely grateful for your contributions. But I also want to jump to questions. So that we have an opportunity to have our audience engage with the experts that we have here today. So I'm going to turn it over to Karen.
Thanks, Marcia. And I have been trying my best to compile comments that have come in the chat box. Please do feel free to add more as, you know, during this Q&A period. I don't know that we're going to be able to get to all of the ones that came in, but I've been capturing them all. And so we can also make sure that there's some that have a few specific points and whatnot that might be able to be shared after the fact as well. So don't hesitate to continue to ask. I've organized these a little bit based on the structure of the presentation, which is also how they kind of came in. So there were a few questions for the researchers, just some specifics about some of the studies and that people wanted a little bit more detail on. So I'm going to just say a couple of them, and then the first panel of researchers here, you can kind of take them in whatever order makes sense to you, and I'm not sure who's best equipped necessarily for them, but just a few that came in. One is about if there are any of those studies cited looked at the impact of adolescent drug use on brain development. A question about whether there were any the particular types of traits or diagnoses, when looking at the psychopathology study in particular, did it specifically focus on PTSD, schizophrenia, antisocial conduct disorders, et cetera? And this was part of the specific study described when assessing the Mendota treatment model. And then a question about whether whether there's information about the racial breakdown of the youth or young adults used to gather the information. So those are, I put three out there just to get people thinking, but if any panelist wants to dive in on one of those, that would be great.
I can speak to several of them. So in terms of the association between adolescent drug use and brain development, in general, we see that adolescent drug use definitely can alter the trajectory of what we would call typical brain development, often in brain regions associated with sensitivity to reward and control of behavior. What seems to really matter in addition to the severity of use is the age of onset, so when the adolescent might start using in the first place. The earlier a youth starts using substances, the more the negative impact we see on brain development and function. We also tend to see that several of the types of early adversity experiences, trauma, depression, and anxiety are strongly correlated with adolescent substance use. So it would be unsurprising if your client expressed these different forms of mental health problems also engaged in substance use. The second question that was raised about the types of traits that were evaluated. So for the Mendota Mental Health, it would be focusing on interpersonal traits. So whether a youth was particularly conning or manipulative, affective traits, so not showing an appropriate range or depth of emotion, impulsive traits, so doing things without thinking or planning, and antisocial traits, you know, engaging in criminal behavior. Behavior or more minor antisocial acts. And so what the authors did was look at people who are higher or lower who were in the Mendota facility on those traits and basically showed that regardless of whether you are high or low on those traits, there was improvement if you received an appropriate type of treatment. And this is one of the very few facilities that is innovating in terms of treatments. Most juvenile facilities will not do the type of heavy lifting that's required for the Mendota treatment. And then, yep.
Oh, sorry. I can jump in on the third question, which is about representativeness. So when we talk about groups of participants for research studies, people might often wonder, well, who are these individuals who are taking part in the research? I would say that there's a wide range of representativeness within the research that is out there. Some studies use what we call convenience samples. That would be, for example, I'm in Cambridge, Massachusetts, so maybe people who live within walking distance of college campuses or something like that, that would represent a group of youth who are not necessarily representative of the broader spectrum of youth that we might see in the United States or more broadly. I think one shorthand way of thinking about this, I think, is that older studies tended to be more likely to use convenience samples and not necessarily have the resources or the commitment to doing the more challenging work in order to recruit and bring in youth to participate in studies who have more barriers to entry or for whom it's more of a burden to do the, to conduct the research themselves. So I will say, though, that there's a pretty large turn in the trends toward representativeness in research. And this is something that the major funders of the kind of research that we do, like the federal government, now attends very carefully to thinking about who comes into our studies and then who the studies can make claims about or make conclusions about, to the point where now, in order to most of the major funded projects on youth brain development actually try to bring in samples that are reflective of youth in the United States today from the perspective of both racial and ethnic diversity, of sex and gender diversity, and of socioeconomic diversity. So one sort of shorthand way to think about it is that the older studies might be less representative, and it's more likely, more and more likely, that the new studies that we're conducting now or that are recently getting published are more representative. So it's a little bit of a change in a wave of change in this area, I think, toward making our research more and more pertinent for youth across the United States more broadly.
I just want to tap in on that because this is very important in terms of the racial disparity that we see in the justice system. And so I know that some of the questions related to will we have a bibliography, and there will be publications that use community samples and had a sufficient representation of different races and minorities to more accurately assess change or differences in that more representative group. But I mean, the punchline is Phil Goff has got this amazing work that he's doing that suggests that these young people, officers, as well as a convenient sample, will rate young people who they think have offended a crime as older than they are if they're African American or Black, whereas if they're white, they're judged to be younger. This research is so important, and I'm happy to also add that in the bibliography for today's panel discussion, because I think those studies are very informative for these cases too. And they're also judged to be more culpable as well, less innocent.
Thanks. So one other kind of category of question for the researchers here was about some of the recidivism studies. So I'm going to read the two questions. These are related, but they're not identical. About first in the studies showing that appropriate interventions are effective in recidivism reduction, is there any further detail on who comprises the adult group in that study? And is there any information on the average or particular length of incarceration for those that comprise that group? And then related but different question of whether there's been any evaluation comparing released juvenile lifers to adult prisoners who've been released. And that may be broader than just thinking about recidivism as an outcome, but those studies looking at effects after release.
So the Mendota Mental Health Facility is for juveniles. So those did not involve anyone over the age of 18. And the research that looked at violent offending and then later some of the work on neural changes now has a 2-year follow-up. So the data point that I sent you was at a 1-year follow-up following the release and completion of that treatment. There's a lot of variability in terms of how long people can follow those who have been in a treatment, whether it's a community treatment or one that occurs within a juvenile facility. What I would say we tend to see, regardless of the follow-up length, is that if a youth is given a treatment that is appropriate for their particular mental health issue or disorder, you see improvement. But if a youth is not given treatment or is given treatment that actually doesn't match the type of emotional and thinking abnormalities that we may see, they could actually get worse and at best just show no change. So really, regardless of whether we're following someone 1 week after release, 1 year or 2 years, the key is about matching an appropriate treatment. And as I've already mentioned, unfortunately, in a lot of justice facilities, the treatments that are most effective are not really being offered. In terms of the second question about comparing juvenile lifers with adults, I believe you said, I'm not aware of any research, but I can certainly dig in a little bit more and send that with a bibliography. What we do tend to see certainly is that length of incarceration matters for brain development, emotional development, personality changes that I mentioned earlier in the talk, and particularly how often someone was put in segregation or completely removed from other people in the facility. That is probably the strongest predictor of negative health and mental health outcomes for youth and adults, regardless of the onset of their incarceration.
Thank you. So if there's nothing further on any of those questions, turning to another kind of group of questions around really what the use of the Wellner Report has looked like so far. And so we got some questions around whether the government has been using the Wellner Report's findings at pre-transfer hearings. And then on the sort of looking at the defense side, whether there's been any filing that people are aware of motions in advance of a hearing, putting a judge on notice of the rulings that were described, limiting the use of the Wellner Report or calling the Wellner Report into question, and also whether any appellate courts have ruled on that.
Well, I'd be happy to take the second question first. In the motion that I litigated in Colorado, since this was a categorical challenge based upon the 18 to 21 year old age group, you know, we filed a motion arguing that the death penalty should be excluded because our client fell into this particular age group. And so in the prosecution's reply, that's when they confronted us with the Wellner Report. And I, you know, actually I, that was the first time I'd encountered the Wellner Report, and we already had an expert on board. So we were able to, have the expert take a look at the report and, you know, sort of neutralize what that report was trying to say. And, you know, we've covered what Wellner and his forensic panel team members are arguing in the report. So in response, in our reply, I did address the problems with the qualifications of the persons who signed on to the report. Dr. Wellner was not a signatory on our report. It was Dr. Seward, DeLisi, and Gilmet. And so I pointed out the lack of qualifications of all three of these individuals, the peer review problems with, or, you know, the fact that we couldn't tell who contributed what to the report, depending on what these three signatories' intent was in signing on to the report. And then also, I did bring up the federal cases that I mentioned in my slideshow, where Wellner and or his colleagues on the forensic panel were disqualified from either talking about certain things in their testimony, you know, in particular future dangerousness, which we've talked about quite extensively here today, and the problems with that in terms of juveniles and emerging adults. And then just, you know, sort of the shady things they've done in these federal cases, posting confidential information on their website, the problems with their peer review process. So, you know, we did notify the judge in advance of the evidentiary hearing. But I would, you know, I think it's appropriate for a reply when you're confronted with the Wellner report and the prosecution's response, which is where you're going to be confronted with it in most cases. And so you can address these things in a reply or through cross-examination at an evidentiary hearing, those kinds of things. You know, we did get an evidentiary hearing in our case, and before the evidentiary hearing, I filed a motion to disqualify the experts for some of the reasons that I've stated. And we were not successful on that motion, but it's significant that the prosecution only brought Dr. Seward to the evidentiary hearing and not DeLisi and Guilmette. So for whatever that's worth. And then Dr. Seward had some problems with his ability to get licensed as a forensic psychologist that we were able to impeach him on, and other things. You know, I felt it was important to bring these issues to the judge's attention in our reply.
Yeah, and as to the first question, I have not personally seen the forensic panel report used in a juvenile transfer hearing. It's a really scary proposition. I don't know, Marcia, if you've seen that in any jurisdictions, but I have not yet.
Yeah, we have not either. I thought that was an interesting question. It is a concerning proposition for sure. I think it for now, it seems like it's been very focused on the extension cases, as far as we can tell. And I note that some folks have asked for some additional resources. Karen is doing a terrific job tracking that going through here. And also I see some requests for briefing. All of the lawyers who are on the panel have been involved in quite a bit of briefing in extension cases, and we'll be happy to make that available to folks as well. Back to you, Karen.
Thanks, Marcia. Yes, and I'm compiling. There's a now great, all sorts of fabulous ideas for what resources would be appropriate to put up alongside the recording of this webinar. So thanks for all of that. Turning now to a few questions about mitigation and post-conviction posture, you know, sort of how best, Amy, your portion of the presentation, kind of what evidence is most effective in some of these contexts. One specific question and some discussion in the chat about the panel's thoughts on risk assessment tools that claim to predict the risk of recidivism as high, moderate, or low, using both stagnant and dynamic factors and relying on research that might be culturally biased and not rooted in brain science. So I guess any reactions to that, and also noting that some have been shown to have disproportionately or adversely affect youth of color.
I have to be honest, I'd be curious if Rebecca or any of the other attorneys have more experience with that. I've not had to combat that in the JLWAP context yet, and it might be a little bit with just the way that Arizona works. You know, we don't have like an explicit future dangerousness type aggravator, and so it's just not as popular of a prosecution theme. So we have not dealt with that in our JLWAP cases, but obviously for the reasons that our experts on the panel pointed out, it's very unreliable. And there's tons of, you know, great research and briefing in the capital context about why we shouldn't rely on it. It can be subject to Daubert challenges. You know, there's so much that you can do with that. So I'm not the best person. I don't have sample briefing, but I could certainly collect it. And somebody else, some of my other colleagues might be able to speak more directly to that.
I think in terms of the research side, most researchers would agree that the way that risk assessment typically is done in a legal context is woefully underspecified, that very rarely would we rely on one particular measure or one feature, or even a combination of a couple of demographic characteristics and a couple of neurocognitive characteristics, which is often what is included. There's a lot of controversy now about, and I saw this in the chat, about diagnoses and mental health problems, particularly as it relates to psychopathy, being used as a common risk assessment, particularly in death row cases. And again, this is one of these things of being aware of what the research actually is showing you is really important, because if you pick up the scientific papers, you will see that there is an effect, that the level of someone's score on a psychopathy measure predicts their institutional violence as well as future violent offending. But the size of that effect is so, so tiny. And anytime a good study adds what we would call moderating factors or additional factors that might better contextualize that effect, you see that things like early life trauma, substance use, and other neurocognitive characteristics end up really explaining a lot of what might result in a higher risk assessment outcome. And so part of the reason why I think it's really important for people to be aware of the work on psychopathy without getting into the label use is because your people you are coming up against are going to include that, are going to mention this type of work. And so being really aware of what the good science is telling you becomes really a really important tool to be able to defend your client most vigorously.
Yeah, and I just want to follow up a little bit on that. I mean, my understanding, I'm certainly not a scientific expert, but my understanding is that psychopathy is not a diagnosis in the DSM. And yet it and the Hare psychopathy checklist are used a lot in especially death penalty proceedings. And my experience is that they're used because it's a very powerful tool to get a death sentence, because juries really, it appeals to their emotions. And when they're confronted with labels like that, that, you know, suggest somebody is going to be dangerous in the future, that is very influential on juries, and it's hard to counteract. So I think that the more you can emphasize the valid science that applies to juveniles and emerging adults, the more successful you will be in counteracting these labels. And, you know, one of the federal cases I cited, the federal judge excluded any labeling of psychopathy. He just prevented Dr. Wellner from even mentioning that word and talking about future dangerousness at all. And I think I mentioned this briefly in my presentation. I think if you can exclude that, then you should try, because it's very damaging and prejudicial in a capital case.
Yeah, and I'll say one more thing on that point, especially since the question was framed in the post-conviction context. I mean, in addition to any, you know, scientific challenges that you have, and there are many, there's also just the bread and butter investigation that we just talked about, right? Like, first of all, if you have a client that's in the collateral review context, you have a period of history that you can point to that, you know, ideally, and frankly, for most of our clients, shows a lot of positive growth, maturity, and adjustment to incarceration. But even in the cases where you have disciplinaries to deal with, you investigate those disciplinaries and, you know, more often than not, they're very mitigatable, right? There's so much context that puts them into perspective. So I think that there's the direct head-on scientific challenge that you can make, but there's also the more circular challenge that you make to that type of narrative, which is by going to really, you know, rolling up your sleeves and investigating everything you can about your client's background, and you'll come up with an alternative narrative that's more credible.
One thing I'll just say in response to something Rebecca mentioned, it is correct that psychopathy is not currently in the DSM, although I will warn that the DSM is not all encompassing. So for example, you know, people witnessing events of 9/11 would not be considered a traumatic event according to the old DSM, but now in the new version is, recognizing that that was a very traumatic event for people. And there's a lot of chatter that psychopathy will be added in the next version of the DSM as a specifier of antisocial personality disorder. I also will say for juveniles, callous unemotional traits, which is believed to be a developmental precursor to psychopathy, is in the DSM now. So for your clients who might be evaluated for conduct disorder and these traits, this is a, you know, clinically verified in the DSM Bible currently. And we see a lot of parallels between callous unemotional traits and some of the adult work in psychopathy. So again, it's just about, I think, arming yourself with the information, not necessarily arguing whether that's appropriate or not.
And I just wanted to add, you know, I didn't want to lose the thread of the question about the racial disproportionality that we often see and the racial implications of some of the risk assessments that are used. That's a very legitimate concern. And there are certainly good reasons to question the validity and the validation of those kinds of assessments. And also because this came up in the context of the transfer question, to also just acknowledge that we really have a few different considerations and research questions that I think are in front of us. We can go from issues of amenability that we often see in the transfer context to future dangerousness, which we might see in death penalty and other extreme sentencing per se. And then, of course, the issues of rehabilitation and maturity in the resentencing process that the court has also called upon litigants to make those kinds of showings in resentencing cases. And I think, I hope that the combination, again, of science and advocacy that you've heard has provided you with some additional inroads to how to think about all three of those questions. So back to you, Karen. I think we still have time for at least one more question or set of questions.
I was about to ask whether you thought we did. So great.
Yeah, let's try. We're not going to get shut off. I can tell everybody that we will not suddenly disappear. So folks can, those who can hang in, let's take one more question.
Okay, great. Well, this is a pair again, as I've been sort of grouping these things. So hopefully this isn't stealing two when you just gave me one here. But these are both related to Amy, to your presentation, but and thinking about sort of proving some of the mitigating characteristics that you described. Specifically, there's a question about proving capacity for rehabilitation or even sort of maturation. And how have you used an expert to do that? And if so, what kind of expert would you look to? And then a slightly different, but in the same vein question about proving remorse in practice and questioning a little bit, you know, what your advice might be on some of the what the sort of pseudoscientific rehab or the programs available through jails that we encourage clients to make use of, you know, things that might be available to them to demonstrate remorse in practice, but with some level of skepticism about their actual value to clients and, you know, whether you have any thoughts on that. So sorry, those are a little bit different. Two for one here.
Sure. Okay. I'll try to be brief. So in terms of proving maturation, I think that, you know, we do what we do in all mitigation investigations. We look to behaviors. So, you know, you can look to your clients. And I want to acknowledge that I have the benefit because I do collateral review. I have history that I get to sort through however many years my client has been incarcerated. I think it can be more of a challenge to develop this type of evidence pretrial, although you do have jail conduct and behavior, but it's a shorter period of time that we're looking at. So, you know, I want to look at things like my client's work history. You know, in Arizona, when we get the records from the prison, we can see they have, you know, evaluations for their work performance, right? So, you know, when my client has all, you know, high levels of evaluations, you know, I want to look to, you know, other types of behaviors like, is your client a parent? Is he able to maintain a relationship with his children, even though, you know, it's through prison? You know, how has he supported that child? You know, you want to get witness testimony from friends, family, people who have observed. Maturity is often, and in this context, I think powerfully proven by acceptance of responsibility. it's very, it's an indicator of maturity when one is able to accept responsibility for their actions, care for others, the clients who help others, their fellow inmates, or help to the best that they're able to, their friends and family outside of prison. To me, those are all ways to demonstrate maturity. And so I would show, like almost anything I'm trying to prove, I'm going to try to prove it in two ways at minimum. Three ways. One is going to be through records. One is going to be through lay witness testimony. And the other is going to be the expert's observation of all of those things. So I want to tie it up with an expert saying, you know, I see that this client has maintained a job, you know, for this amount of time and gotten outstanding evaluations for this amount of time. I see that this client has not had a disciplinary write-up in this amount of time, or that all of his disciplinaries were shortly after his incarceration when he was 18, 19, 20, 21. And now that he is in his 30s, we don't see that anymore. So that you have all the little pieces coming together. In terms of proving remorse, I think that it comes the same way. Those expressions of remorse can come from people that are close to your client, their pen pals, their friends, their family, anyone who they've articulated remorse to. And also, you always want to get their own voice whenever you can. And so that's very powerfully done through a really good expert. Like I said, someone who's good at clinical interviewing, who can talk to the client about the crime, and who can capture his expression. I also work with my clients on their ability to express emotion because, as I mentioned, they might be actually very remorseful, but they don't always have the skill set or, you know, the demeanor that it gets expressed in a way that is impressive to people in power, decision makers. And so working with them on their ability to emote when they're expressing their remorse. Lastly, you know, one of the scariest things for me moving from capital work to jail walk work is that our clients are expected to talk at their parole hearings. And I mean, I cannot tell you how terrifying that has been for me and how blown away I've been by my clients' abilities to handle that incredibly stressful situation and be articulate and genuine and sincere. A lot of work goes into getting them to that place where I think they feel confident enough to do that. But they do it, they blow me away. So that'd be my two cents on that.
So I know we're at the end. And again, I want to thank our panelists and I want to thank all of you who have stayed with us this afternoon through this conversation. A couple of administrative issues. Those of you who registered for the webinar through Evite, we do have your emails, and I think we will have an ability to email all of you with some of the resources that have been asked for. I know that Karen has been trying diligently, as have our panelists, to put some things up that you all have asked for. I've also just asked Karen to add my email and her email at this point. Particularly folks who did not register through Evite, if you would like to email us so that we can make sure that you get access to the resources that, as I said, you all have been asking for. We also, I recognize that there's been an enormous amount of information shared here, very rich conversation, and undoubtedly generated many more questions than we could answer. Any parting comments from any of my panelists?
Thank everyone for your incredible work and for spending the time with us. And just from the capital perspective, I am stunned moving into the JLWAP work how equally complex and time consuming it is. So I guess just don't underestimate the work that's involved. And we're here to support you, and we hope you'll support us as we all continue to do this work.
And, you know, I actually did want to add one thing, which I think is somewhat of a strategy question. I wanted to, first of all, underscore really the importance of looking to state constitutional opportunities. As lawyers, there may be better opportunities in some of our state courts than in the federal courts. Let's keep that in mind. And then also because we've been talking about extension cases as well as LWAP resentencing cases.
Post-conviction is a remedy, as well as certainly thinking about direct appeals as well. Sometimes the direct appeal in the extension cases actually might work better than the post-conviction remedy because of concerns about what the standard is. So lots to think about. Again, thank you so much. I'm going to ask my panelists if you guys can stay in a Zoom meeting. And thank you to all the rest of you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Marcia.